You're listening to Nick Luck Daily, bringing you the latest news and the best interviews from around the world of horse racing. This episode is brought to you by the Racehorse Owners Association, by Thoroughbred Racing Commentary's Global Rankings in partnership with the Saudi Cup, and by the Fitzdares Club. Hi there, welcome to the show, bringing you the latest news and sharpest insights from around the racing world every weekday. It is Friday, October the 23rd, and quite a few points to update you on since last we met. And first of those, having discussed the Cox Plate potential vet scratchings yesterday, is that Magic Wand has indeed been taken out of the Cox Plate. She had an abscess and that hasn't recovered in time. However, the horse about whom there was the most controversy and consternation in our conversation with Jason Richardson yesterday and with Jane Mangan was Armory, and he has passed the vet's test. He will run in the Cox Plate, and Jason passes on a strong word for his chances as well. As for the United States of America, where we build towards the Breeders' Cup, it's been another very, very trying few hours for top trainer Bob Baffert, because his filly Gamine, who was the subject of a significant inquiry earlier in the season owing to a medication violation at Oaklawn Park, has once again violated medication controls after her third place finish in the Kentucky Oaks. The New York Times correspondent Joe Drape, who has been on this story consistently all year, has splashed it again. Baffert, through his attorney, has issued a lengthy defense of procedures, but this is not something that is going to go away anytime soon and will be causing him more sleepless nights, no doubt. And on a rather happier note, you will remember my interview last week with Welsh trainer Sheila Lewis, who's only got six horses. She won with three of them on the same day, while the runners continued. She's now five for her last five, and the last two of those have been ridden by Katie Powell, to whom she gave a massive mention before she'd ever sat on a horse in public 7 days ago on this podcast. So all power to Sheila and to Katie. And it is to Jumps Racing we turn our attention, and to Cheltenham. Their season begins today with the showcase fixture. Cornelius Lysett joins me. Cornelius, just explain to everybody why this meeting today at Cheltenham is quite so significant.
Well, it was, I suppose, down to an accident of timing that the Cheltenham Festival in March was taking place as the pandemic and the whole talk around the pandemic was taking hold on both Britain and Ireland. So everybody was talking about the pandemic and what it was going to mean and how it was arriving in the British Isles. And the Cheltenham Festival was going ahead perfectly legitimately at exactly the same time. Other activities were taking place at exactly the same time. Premier League football the weekend before Cheltenham. An important European football match involving Liverpool at Anfield during Cheltenham. And concerts and other big events and so on as well. And then there was, I suppose everyone wanted something else to sort of discuss and to turn its attention on, but keeping COVID in mind. And it suddenly seemed ridiculous that many thousands of people were coming over 4 days to Cheltenham. This was the feeling of the outside world. Look what's going on here. These people just don't care. And then you heard people saying, oh, we were at the races. It felt like the last hurrah before everything was going to close down, which I didn't personally feel, but it did feel a bit strange at the time that the festival was going ahead and COVID was beginning to sort of consume these islands. And I'm afraid that the word Cheltenham became a new C word. I don't think there's any other way of putting it. And that has continued for some time, very often unfairly, and it did irritate me, my former colleagues at the BBC, that every time people talked about activities that were taking place during those early COVID weeks, and they always talked to about Cheltenham and didn't always talk about the football at Anfield or the Premier League or the Six Nations or concerts, etc., etc. So, yeah, Cheltenham became a C word. It took some time to shake that off. And now we are many months later, and it's the start of the new season at Cheltenham. And I've actually been quite surprised, quite pleasantly surprised. I thought there would be quite a lot of hoo-ha in the general media about, oh, those awful people, in inverted commas, those awful people at Cheltenham are racing again. They don't care about the rest of us. But actually, there hasn't been that much talk. Maybe there's a feeling that that Cheltenham has suffered enough. But yeah, the season is getting underway with the first of the two days of the open. Do they call this one the showcase? The showcase meeting.
Yeah.
First race at 1:50. I think Cheltenham has handled it really, really well, because on the whole, it's not said anything. It has allowed the brickbats to be thrown. It's known that it didn't do anything wrong. Government said go ahead at the time. And it sort of kept its head down on the whole. And it's probably done okay, Cheltenham and the Jockey Club. And it's probably quite relieved to... I turned on the radio this morning, Radio 4 Today programme. The two tips came from Cheltenham. I thought they're bound to say, oh, first meeting at Cheltenham since the controversially staged festival. But that wasn't mentioned, certainly, when I was listening. But it's important because clearly, in terms of public health regulations, etc., Cheltenham will be watched closely. And all the other things that go with Cheltenham. And we know that sometimes things are less straightforward than those triumphant moments, that they'll be watched carefully as well.
Well, I've been speaking to the managing director of the West Region for the Jockey Club, Ian Renton, to find out how he is looking forward, if that's the right phrase, to the Cheltenham season beginning again.
Well, I think as many people have experienced, racing behind closed doors is something of a surreal experience. And it will seem very strange going into 2 days racing at Cheltenham with only the participants and some owners present. But we therefore absolutely got to concentrate on having a fantastic experience out on the track, producing fantastic racing, so that people who might normally be at the racecourse can enjoy it from the comforts of their home watching it on television.
And just in terms of looking ahead through the season, the big question is whether you think that there'll be any sort of crowd come festival time in March. What's your intelligence telling you at the moment?
I mean, at the moment, we are fearing the worst, and we're working on the basis that come March, we're still likely to be in the position of having no crowds and behind closed doors with some owners present, but as always, hoping for the best, that something could change dramatically and allow a few people to attend the festival, or maybe a halfway house, that we might be allowed some form of hospitality to be part of the festival as well. But at the moment, as I say, we're working on the worst case scenario, that the situation we're going to be in this coming weekend could still be in place for March.
Do you think the sport's at a bit of a crunch point in that regard, insofar as it can either choose to just say, okay, we're happy with behind closed doors, or press on, possibly in the face of some quite sort of stern public opposition?
I think we've got to get the balance absolutely right. It's essential for the racing industry that racing behind closed doors continues. I think for owners, trainers, jockeys, stable staff, the loss of racing altogether would be an absolute disaster. So we don't want to push too far. That might in any way jeopardise that taking place. However, we also see the activity in restaurants, etc., on the high street. And it seems, again, strange that we can't be allowed some form of hospitality in what will probably be even more or significantly more stringent conditions than takes place in most restaurants around the country. So I think, we would still be pushing for a little bit of release and to allow a few people to come racing over the next few months.
Ian, Cheltenham was rather hauled over the coals after the festival, as it was one of the last major sporting events, and obviously huge crowds every day just before the lockdown. To what extent on a personal level did that criticism sting?
I think one gets a little bit inured to criticism in any sort of role with any form of public profile. But I felt particularly for the rest of our teams and anyone involved that an awful lot of the criticism was very unfair as we said at the time, we followed the government guidelines, we followed the government advice to continue racing in exactly the same way. We're working to the government guidelines and the government advice now. So I personally did not take too great an affront, but I certainly felt for many members of our team that were did feel that they're being very unfairly judged.
And was that judgment in any way decisive in informing your policy as to how you go about things this season?
I don't think so at all. I think we are very conscious that everything we do has to be as stringent as it possibly can be, but that would always be the case with what we do at Cheltenham. And I think in exactly the same way we worked with the government, with DCMS at that time back in March, we're doing exactly the same now in working closely with them to see if we can find a solution going forward that at some stage might open the door to a few people being able to come racing.
Ian, you were dealt a blow the other day with the news that neither the Racing Post nor your very long-standing sponsor, RSA, would continue with their sponsorships at the Cheltenham Festival. How worried are you about that?
I'm not concerned on that front at all. I mean, I think every year we will have sponsors that come to the end of their contractual arrangements. And, you know, I think 2 years ago, I think we had 12 of our festival sponsors coming to the end of their contract. You would always expect companies to occasionally look at changing the direction of how they want to become involved. They might choose to leave sports and work with the arts. They may choose a different sport. So there will always be sponsors leaving the sport and sponsors joining the sport. And two at this stage of the season is not the least bit unusual. And, you know, I'm delighted to say we're in advanced talks with people wishing to replace them. Saying that, it is always a huge sadness when you have some sponsors that have been with us a long time, and the RSA particularly being our longest standing sponsor of the festival. You know, it is a great sadness when we lose anyone, but it is a natural progression in sponsorships and partnerships that occasionally they come up and give an opportunity for someone else to take on, in this case, you know, two brilliant novice chasers.
Ian Renton there, and I think a couple of important points there, Cornelius. First, that he is entirely planning for a whole season without crowds, which is quite depressing when you think ahead to the festival, but we've just got to be realistic, I think.
And quite depressing when you think of the finances. His finance team must be dreading that. At least they're getting something from media rights. But, you know, these things rely, don't they, on the proverbial bums on seats, people paying their dollar to come through the gate. As we sit here discussing this, we hear that Wales is about to be hit by further restrictions in Greater Manchester. I suppose racing to an extent is collateral damage in all this. I suppose if racing was going ahead and somebody else was collateral damage, we'd say hard luck on them. So, you know, these are really difficult times. The whole British Horse Racing Authority, BHA situation, you know, it's gone a little bit quieter in recent days. I think that's because Andy Burnham's been on the steps of the mayor's offices in Manchester, and there've been all sorts of chatter in South Yorkshire as well, the mayor there. And they've been doing deals with government to really help people, try and help people who are in real difficulty. Now, racing's in real difficulty as well, but it's perhaps the subject of racing and crowds has just taken an inevitable step back during these times, but they mustn't take a step back and go quiet. So these are interesting days ahead when everything settles down as far as the tier two and tier three restrictions are concerned.
Yeah, I think you'll find that after the weekend, there'll be a new policy formulation from the BHA. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if they do start to step away from football and the Premier League's approach to government and try and kick out on their own now.
and emphasize the wide open spaces. You know, there was some controversy. It's the start of the point-to-point season this weekend with fixtures at Ottery St Mary and Maysmore. And there was some difficulty between the officials running the Gloucester races at Maysmore and the local council. And the main point made by officials at the point-to-point was, you know, look at the wide open spaces. There aren't going to be that many people coming to this event. It is important for the local economy. It is important for the equestrian economy as well. And look at the big wide open spaces. And I think in that particular case, the council officials were convinced. But that, you know, that is one of the drums to really beat, isn't it? Look at the vast space of, well, Newmarket, but they won't be racing there for much longer, but Cheltenham, even though it's in the town of Cheltenham, masses of space there. You know, it's really important to keep making those points. The other thing that struck me yesterday, did you see the pronouncement that everybody who's on a race course is to wear a yes. face covering?
Yes, absolutely. From Monday, everybody is to wear a face covering at all times, apart from, I'm happy to say, apart from broadcast media whilst they're conducting an interview or on air. But at all other times, all face masks to be worn inside or outside.
I imagine that the nuances of that are subject to debate. But I thought the most important part of the announcement from the authority actually was this just makes it really plain and straightforward. And that's almost more important, isn't it? That I was at Ascot on Champions Day. You know, are you allowed your mask? Must you wear your mask here? Must you wear it there, etc.? There is an element of confusion. So if the rule is just the rule, go ahead. Even though people will debate the rights and wrongs of whether you should have to wear a mask when you're outside wandering around in the fresh air, the fact is it does make it sort of more straightforward for everybody.
Cornelius, you mentioned point to pointing, a new broadcasting venture for you this weekend.
Yeah, I tell you what, I haven't seen my name mentioned on the back page of the Telegraph for some time, but Marcus Armitage on the back page of today's sports bulletin, the Telegraph, says this is a game changer. Basically, what the point-to-pointing is doing in Devon and Cornwall specifically is live streaming, and it's hopefully quite professional operation, which I'm fronting, in fact, which starts at Bishop's Court, Ottery St Mary on Saturday, the East Devon point-to-point, the first of the season, and they will be live streaming their first three fixtures in the Devon and Cornwall area for anybody via their website. Can I give the website a quick plug?
Of course.
Which is pointingdc, as in Devon and Cornwall, pointingdc.co.uk. And then on Sunday, Maysmore is gloucesterraces.co.uk. They're live streaming their event as well. And the idea is to go forward and to ensure that point-to-pointing has the threat to it is that if the season didn't get going, having lost a lot of fixtures and a lot of money last time round, it would be pretty bad news as far as the future was concerned. So not only are they really trying to get the season going with a bit of song and dance around this weekend, but also this live streaming from Devon and Cornwall and from the Gloucester Races event on Sunday, which is important. According to Marcus Armitage, writing in the paper today, they've got quite a lot of students from Falmouth University's film and television course, which he says they get the experience and no doubt the odd rollicking from Cornelius. How dare he? Anyway, we're doing this. And if, just final quick thought on point-to-pointing, if we need to consider the importance of point-to-pointing in relation to National Hunt racing, if you look at the novice riders, the champion novice riders, from the Devon and Cornwall area for the last few years. Let me just throw a few names at you. Michael Hurd, Kieran Edgar, Jamie Bagari, Chester Williams, David Noonan, Rex Dingle, Brian Carver, Millie Wanicott, Megan Nichols, Bryony Frost, Lizzie Kelly. So that shows, doesn't it, really, how it starts. And I am told the name to follow in the weeks ahead, particularly in Devon and Cornwall, is Isaac Buncle, who works for Philip Hobbs. Isaac Buncle, B-U-N-C-L-E, who is a very good rider. And Philip Hobbs confirmed that to me.
Jockey's names just get better and better. I thought we'd reached the peak when we got Rex Dingle, but Isaac Buncle might be the best yet.
Go on, Isaac.
Cornelius, for the moment, thank you very much. Well, it's time now for our weekly look at Thoroughbred Racing Commentary's global rankings. Last week, we focused on the jockeys. Today, we turn our attention to the trainers. So here goes then, at 10, steady at 10, Steve Asmussen, the man who marshalled the careers of Curlin and Gunrunner. At 9, Jamie Richards from New Zealand, Melody Bell, his big stable star. At 8, down 1, James Cummings, leaving Chris Waller, his compatriot, up 1. At 7, the trainer of Very Elegant, the Caulfield Cup winner. Bob Baffert, difficult night for him again. He's steady at 6, and he's been passed by his compatriot Brad Cox, the highest climber in 2020, at 5, Monomoy Girl en route to the Breeders' Cup Distaff. Aidan O'Brien has dropped a few places in recent years. He's steady at 4. 3, Charlie Appleby is down 1 with his lack of recent big race runners. John Gosden down 1 at 2 after a disappointing Champions Day. And up 2 in the top spot is Primus Inter Pares in the United States and all over the globe, the mighty, mighty Chad Brown with his favoured meet, the Breeders' Cup. Just around the corner, James Willoughby is here with me. That's got the blood pumping, James.
It certainly has. What's interesting about the American trainers, Nick, and you obviously know this a lot better than me, having been on the ground there, is that certainly amongst the racing public, opinion is divided. They don't seem to receive the kind of love that our top trainers do unequivocally. I mean, you come across any horse player in America and they'll have some strong and often negative words about one or two of the leading practitioners there, and it's quite interesting how opinionated people are.
Yes, there isn't quite the same level of deference, I don't think. You very rarely hear people here expressing diverse opinions about the abilities of John Gosden and Aidan O'Brien to take the two trainers from Britain and Ireland in the top 10 here, though you would have people expressing vastly differing opinions about, say, Baffert and Steve Asmussen.
And that leads me nicely on to that John Gosden is deposed as number one this week, because John Gosden had, by his own standards, and in fact by anyone's standards, a pretty miserable Champions Day. And of course, his horses didn't perform in the Arc de Triomphe either, despite having the first two in the market. And it's quite interesting how we seem to live in an era in this country where it almost is sort of heresy to ever sort of question the trainer's part in a series of moderate performances. And it seems to me as a racing fan that it's an odd thing that you can have a succession of brilliant training performances, but never, ever a moderate training performance. I mean, you could count on one hand the number of times in the last 25 years where a trainer of a big race runner who has underperformed has come out and said, yeah, that's on me. I overtrained the horse, or I wish I hadn't sent him so hard for that last gallop. And I think that's one of the things that takes away from the sport a little bit. I think while we don't want to see people pilloried on insufficient evidence, we don't want the kind of culture that pervades in football, for example, it would be nice occasionally to hear John Gosden say, that's on me, folks. And I think the reason why this persists is, first of all, maybe the longstanding view of many fans that the media in this country is a little supine. But leaving that to one side, I think perhaps a more significant reason is the fact that the performance of trainers and jockeys is assessed reputationally in this country, and we don't really have a set of proper metrics to appreciate how good trainers are or aren't. We go on prize money, which of course is an absurd way to assess how good a trainer is. And so if we have no proper way to evaluate how successful a trainer has been, and it's always a one-way street of praise, then it doesn't really benefit a trainer to ever admit that he or she has made a mistake. It's not a good career move to do so. We see, for example, Oisin Murphy in the riders' ranks, who occasionally issues these sort of great plaintiffs about he's done this and that wrong in races. And, you know, people seem to like that, and they seem to think that gives him a human element. And I'd like to hear a bit more of that from our leading trainers from time to time, but I suspect it's a vain wish.
Yeah, I mean, self-promotion is much more readily accepted now, isn't it, than it used to be. If you'd been a rampant self-promoter on social media 10 years ago, you'd have been pilloried. Now, it's just everybody's doing it. So, well, if you can't beat them, join them.
Can I add a little asterisk to that?
Yeah, sure.
It seems to me that it's perfectly acceptable to brag about your looks, but not very acceptable to brag about your intellect. Would you agree with that? People post flattering pictures of themselves at their wedding and things like that, looking as if they've been kind of airbrushed, whatever. And people go, oh, don't you look great? But if you ever sort of say that you've read War and Peace and enjoyed it or something, you'll be put in the stocks and labelled a sued for the rest of the time. So,
well, David Yates managed to get the word ersatz into his opening sentence on this podcast the other day. So,
well, he's one that doesn't care, and that's why I like him so much.
Okay, let's talk about these top 10 trainers again. What are the aspects of this list that might have people raising an eyebrow or two, and why?
Right. Well, as ever, it is this idea that people say that you can't compare trainers from different countries. Now, I've always found that interesting is that people say things like that, then they instantly compare other things which are just as difficult to compare. And of course, every object which exists in the same domain as another one can easily be compared with another, provided you construct a context-neutral environment. That's a posh, that's a really kind of involved way of saying that you try and kind of like equalize the variables. So, for example, Chad Brown has got more graded stakes to aim at. So each one in our system counts for proportionately less. Jamie Richards, for example, who's a New Zealand-based trainer, has New Zealand graded stakes, which are relatively easy to win, group races, sorry, which are easy to win, and Australian ones, which proliferate more but are harder to win. And so we can take account of all those different variables to compare trainers across the globe. And we have this intermixing that I've mentioned in previous weeks, which is with the commingling of trainers in events like Hong Kong, Breeders' Cup, the Australian Spring Carnival, things like that, enables us to create this hierarchy simply by comparing who beats whom and how often. And so the reason that we have John Gosden, Charlie Appleby, Aidan O'Brien in that order is not to say that Aidan O'Brien's career accomplishments are less than those of Charlie Appleby or John Gosden. Of course they're not. But for the vast majority of our rankings, which started in 2014, Aidan O'Brien was our world number one. But now he seems to have this scattergun policy when it comes to group races. And because we're trying to compare runners on, we're trying to equalize for how many horses a trainer has, then our algorithm scores him down. But of course, this shouldn't matter to anybody else who's evaluating trainers by a different method. If you just want to think of Aidan O'Brien as being a constant, that his runners are, he's the greatest trainer of all time, always will be, that's fine. We've no problem with that. But what we're trying to do is we're trying to predict the order of finish in a future race. And so our rankings are volatile. Recent form counts for us more than past form. And the number of runners a trainer's had, even though we discount Aidan O'Brien for pacemakers, we don't really include his lesser runners as counting as much as his prime runner in each race. In recent years, it is true that his efficiency has gone down. Now, the reason it's gone down is that it's less important than it was, because through his earlier exploits and those of the brilliant minds at Coolmore, they've virtually got hegemony over European racing. So they don't need to worry about their results on a single runner basis. They have a portfolio approach, which is optimal for their organization. And they've reached a level of absolute domination of European racing through their racing and breeding exploits as a result of their earlier, more careful, more precise policy. Now, it behoves them to approach races like the Derby in a multiple runner portfolio, and it's highly successful.
It's almost inconceivable that Chad Brown will concede that top spot anytime soon, given what's coming up for him.
Well, you've got a personal knowledge of this that I lack, but to me, I think he's a brilliant placer of horses. He seems to know instinctively a whole range of horses, from young dirt horses to the kind of Judd Monty turf horses that he gets. Exactly, he maps their careers so beautifully, and they go from race to race. The American system, of course, lends itself to this, because obviously there's a sequence of races nicely spaced apart in each division, and Brown's brilliant at exploiting all the opportunities for horses, not just on the Eastern Seaboard, but across the whole of America too.
And James, we will be back next week to take a look at the top 10 horses again. There might be some scope for change, but it looks as though Magical could yet claim top spot at the end of the year.
Hey, Nick, and if these rankings don't work out next week, well, that's on me.
James, thank you. So my thanks to James Petuian Renton earlier on. Cornelius is still with me and is going to give you a winner for the day, which I would imagine comes from
Hexham. Oh, no, there isn't a mission at Hexham. No, it comes from Cheltenham. The 3 o'clock, the square in the air.com handicap hurdle. in that race. It's a you're doing Cheltenham, aren't you? So you will have studied the 3 o'clock, which has got about 535 runners.
Yep.
And I think a horse of Nicky Henderson's called Hijack's very prominent in the betting. It struck me Nicky Henderson's other runner was the one, Fix Sun is the name of the horse, a Munier and Suede horse, which won a race at Market Raisin in January in very good style, and then was probably caught out by the at very short odds by the very tight track at Fakenham subsequent to that. It struck me that Fix Sun, who is available certainly with my bookmaker at 8-1, looked to Daryl Jacob riding, looked a really interesting contender. But, you know, what a good weekend with Cheltenham, the second day of the showcase fixture to come tomorrow. Plenty of runners there. We've already said the point-to-point season gets going. The last group won the Vertem Futurity at Doncaster as well. And, plenty to look forward to over the next 48 hours or so.
Absolutely. Cornelius, thank you very much. Thank you for listening. Don't forget, if you do enjoy this podcast, to tell all your friends, to rate us, to review us, to subscribe on SoundCloud, Spotify, Google, or iTunes, or just about anywhere else. And we will see you after the weekend. Have a good one. Thanks so much for listening. Bye-bye. You've been listening to Nick Luck Daily, brought to you in association with FitzDares, the Racehorse Owners Association, and Thoroughbred Racing Commentary.